Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 116 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. One of the world's most well-known and beloved medieval saints is a figure who can be found in his humble robes everywhere from frescoes to bird feeders, and whose intercession you'd seek out for help with your pets. He is, of course, Saint Francis. Francis' story is a fairly familiar one, full of trials, tribulations, and miracles. Many of his tribulations came in the form of physical illness and disability, making it challenging for him to meet the demands that stemmed from his ever-increasing popularity. But just because we expect a saint to endure at least some suffering, it doesn't mean that we should forget about the human being who experienced it. Enter Dr. Donna Trembinski. Donna is an associate professor of history at St. Francis Xavier University and the author of many articles on disability, trauma, Christianity, and St. Francis. Her new book, Illness and Authority, Disability in the Life and Lives of St. Francis of Assisi, talks about just that, the ways in which we can learn about the person behind the saint by studying the way that his physical life had an impact on his spiritual life. Here's our conversation on who St. Francis was, the impact of illness and disability on his life, and what we can learn when we look into a saint's humanity. Well, thank you, Donna, for joining me to talk about St. Francis. I'm really excited about this because he's such a pivotal figure, not just in the Middle Ages, but now. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm always delighted to talk about Francis.
He's great, right? And he's one of the few saints that I think we have so much documentary evidence for. But I mean, a lot of that is tricky, which I would like to get into later. But starting from the beginning, who was St. Francis?
So St. Francis is a saint. We don't actually even know exactly when he was born, probably around 1198 or 1200. And he lived a relatively short life. He died in 1226 in the fall. He's most famous for starting the Franciscan order. It's an order of friars, which are kind of like monks in that they dedicate their life to God. But unlike monks, they don't live separate from society. They live in society. And so they engage in actions like preaching. And for Francis himself, he wanted his order to not actually hold any property. This becomes a real bone of contention with the Franciscans eventually. Not hold any property. They were expected to His initial followers were expected to beg for their food and their shelter every day. So to live a life of poverty and a life dedicated to service and to God.
Exactly. And for Francis as a person, this is a huge reversal for him, wasn't it? Because I think he was born into wealth and he was born into privilege. And then, you know, he becomes the saint that has absolutely nothing. He owns nothing, and that's actually a whole important part of his practice. So who was he as a young man?
It is true. Francis was the son of a fairly wealthy cloth merchant from Assisi, and his young life was, he was a bit of a party animal. He liked to, you know, he enjoyed the fine life. He did eventually end up having to go to war against Perugia. And it appears to be that experience of war and possibly being a prisoner of war actually changed his life. But there is a discussion to be had that Francis was able to do that, to turn to a life of absolute poverty because he was in that position of wealth initially, that you know, he had wealth to give up. And so it's only because he was privileged middle class or even upper class that he was able to make this enormous change and turn to his life of poverty.
It was actually pretty difficult for Francis to divest himself of his wealth, wasn't it? I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought he was actually brought to court by his dad. And like, there was this whole scene where he like strips naked in the middle of the court. Like, this was kind of a big deal for him to throw off his wealth, wasn't it?
It was. And his father certainly wasn't very happy with his move to dedicate himself to God. And that scene, which is really famous in a lot of movies about Francis, actually has some truth to it. We find that in the earliest hagiographies about Francis. And it's really important. It's actually like a legal action that he's removing himself from his father's patrimony, denying that he will ever inherit anything from his father, removing himself from the family business. So that act is actually, it's a pivotal moment in the hagiography because it shows his clear intent to live a life dedicated to God. But it's also important legally so that it makes clear to everyone that Francis is no longer his father's heir.
So yeah. And that's what I really like about this story is that so many of the saints have a very murky story, and you know, it takes place sometime in the distant past and we don't know what's happened, and you actually have kind of an idea of the legal case in which Francis is deciding to split from his father because he became ascetic and he became a saint in a time that there were more records, I suppose, and that makes it a little bit easier. So he was sent off to fight. He became a prisoner of war. And then it's after that that he decides to devote himself to God. And all of the neighbors and all the townspeople think this is really crazy, don't they?
They do. They do. They're kind of shocked at Francis's abrupt change in behavior. And they're at a loss to explain why he's acting in a way that they perceive as extremely problematic. You know, after he returned home from being a prisoner of war, and I guess I'll take a step back and say, we're not absolutely sure he was a prisoner of war. We don't have records that demonstrate that. We have one very, very early life that talks about that, one. And it's not Thomas of Celano, who wrote many lives of Francis and is in some ways a very reliable source. But enough work has been done that that looks likely, that he was a prisoner of war and was in prison probably for a couple of years before he was sent home. And he was probably sent home not because the war between Assisi and Perugia was over, but because he was sick. That would be the only reason you'd be allowed home as a prisoner of war. And so after that period, he recuperates a little bit in his family home, but he is a really changed individual. He doesn't take pleasure in nature the way he used to. He can't feel joy. And so it looks like there's some long-term effects of the imprisonment. And then he begins to start realizing that he can find direction in his life by dedicating himself to God. He's not fully committed yet, but he wants to try out this life. And he does that by doing things that his neighbors do find a little bit difficult to take. So he like lives in a cave for a while. And he decides he's going to, you know, he has a vision that says, Francis, you're going to rebuild my church. God says that to him. And so he literally goes and starts like moving bricks and trying to rebuild a local church that's broken down. And his family members and his friends have no idea what to do with that. And so they sometimes come and try and help him. They drag him back to his father's house when he doesn't want to go back. And they sometimes hurl abuse at him because, you know, people's reactions are different. So yeah, what he does after he comes back from Perugia is really, it's very difficult for his family and friends to take.
Yeah. Okay. Let's start there because I think that's kind of the place where you have in your scholarship noticed that disability and illness start to really have an impact on how he is as a person and his ministry and things like that. And I thought that was something that really jumped out in the book was that when he starts to break with his traditional role in society, people comment on the fact that he's emaciated. They comment on the fact that he might be demented. So can you talk a little bit about that period in his life, how he might have started to become ill, partly because of his past and partly because of his practice and how that affected him?
Yeah. In fact, I argue in the book that actually starts before then, that he was probably ill in Perugia, which is why he was sent home, and that he does... It looks like when he's sent home, he isn't even able to walk and that he slowly recuperates. He's able to walk with a cane for a while and he gets a little bit healthier and a little bit healthier. We've already talked about how Thomas of Celano, who wrote the very first life of Francis, talks about how Francis doesn't have joy in, you know, nature, which he always used to. So I think the illness is actually probably comes from his experience as a war prisoner. Whatever happened to him, I argue in the book that that impacts his life, the rest of his life. It impacts his whole life. And then how he treats his body after he dedicates himself to God continually adversely affects him because he has that underlying illness from the war. So for instance, when he goes to try and rebuild this church at San Damiano, he throws himself into the task and he literally starts trying to, like literally he's rebuilding the church with his hands. Now you have to remember Francis is middle class, wealthy middle class, maybe upper class. And he doesn't have a lot of experience. And the priest who's on site really understands this and says, what are you doing? He actually says to Francis that he's not capable of doing this kind of rough work. And so right from the very beginning, it's really clear that Francis had what some of his hagiographers call a delicate constitution that wasn't well suited to the kind of work and asceticism that he eventually dedicated his life to. But that's been overlooked by scholars. It's been overlooked that the illness that caused his conversion experience, which is a very common hagiographical trope, actually continued afterwards. And so when he starts to dedicate himself to God, we still see evidence of Francis being ill and potentially infirm even in those acts that he's doing at the beginning of his ministry.
Yeah. It occurs to me that we should probably mention that hagiography is the saint's life. It's a saint's biography. We're just talking away and I'm like, oh yeah, and maybe not everyone knows this.
Good thought.
Now, what's interesting when we're coming to that moment where he's like building the church and he's maybe not up to it physically, the priest is giving him some medicine, we think, in some of the earlier sources, but then that's taken out in some of the later sources. That's something that you dig into a little bit. So tell us about that. Why would they want to take that out to say that he was taking medicine when he needed it?
Yeah, that's one of the major findings of the book. Thanks for bringing it up. Is that early kind of references to Francis's illness and treatment, especially treatment for Francis's illness, get taken out. So maybe at some point we're going to have to talk about the various lives of Francis and how complicated that tradition is. But so by the time we get to the official life of St. Francis that is written around 40 years after his death, a lot of the early references to treatments, like the priest giving him fine foods that suit his constitution, giving him medicine in terms like an electuary, is actually taken out. But it's not only the Bonaventure. I blame Bonaventure for a lot in my discussion of Francis. But it's not just Bonaventure that does it. And in particular, that story about the priest giving Francis medicine, the modern translators of that episode, which we find in the Assisi compilation, and I don't know why this happened, but they don't translate the word for electuaria, which is a kind of medicine that's suspended in sugar. They translate that as sweet rather than medicine, which is what a medieval person would have understood that to be. So it's not just medieval authors that are doing it. I think there's such a resistance to seeing that Francis's illness impacted his entire life that even modern translators sometimes don't necessarily want to demonstrate that clearly in their translations.
Yeah, because as you say, suffering is a huge part of saints' lives, saints' biographies, so much so that I was telling you earlier that when I read Francis's life, I didn't read his illness. It does mention that he's ill in pretty much all his biographies, but I didn't think of it in terms of his actually being physically ill so much as maybe he is ill from the fact that he's fasting too much or that kind of thing. And that's so common that I didn't think much of it, but you did. So why did you pull this out? Why did you decide to write about Francis and his illness and his disability, which we will get to too?
It's a good question. So I studied Francis for my thesis, which I wrote many, many years ago now. And I was like you. I was kind of like, he was one of my many examples of how suffering is important in saints' lives to demonstrate their holiness, right? Their spiritual authority is strengthened by the fact that they suffer on earth. And it wasn't until I started thinking about how Francis actually was separated from his ability to lead his order around 1223 that I started thinking about why that happened. And some of the sources cite his illness as a reason for that, and some of the sources don't. Bonaventure in particular doesn't. It was really that question that got me digging. And then when I actually, 10 years ago, I built a spreadsheet of all the instances of illness in Francis's life. Do you know how many I came up with? I was shocked. 98 times, different times in the sources, 98 separate instances in the sources where we talk about his illness. And I thought, why is no one talking about this? Except for the sort of generic, you know, he was ill throughout his life, he suffered for God, and he got stigmata. And those are the three things you know about Francis. And no one actually talks about in depth how he suffered throughout his entire life and how that impacted his ability to lead his order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's get into that. So we've talked about his life when he's first converted, he's living kind of on the street. He's just starting to build his ministry. He does some crazy things, audacious things. Like he travels to Egypt and talks to the Sultan, I think, and says, you know, stop being Muslim. You need to be Christian, which is so gutsy. And the Sultan laughs in his face and he comes back. And then I'm not sure of the chronology exactly if this is before or after, but the Pope says, yes, you can have an order. You can start to run it. We'll call it the Franciscans. And that's cool. And the Pope didn't allow everybody to have an order.
No, so they were quite strict at that point. Yeah.
Right. So Francis starts to lead his order. It starts to get busy. And then he starts to take a step back. And this is actually kind of rare, I think, when you think about people who have created their own orders, that they're control freaks. They're always in control, especially Benedict, perhaps. But Francis is taking a step back. And for you, you think through the work that you've done that this is related to his illness. So tell us about this time when Francis's order is being built up, but he's starting to have to take a backseat deliberately. How do you see this time in his life?
Yeah. So we're covering about 20 years of his life here. Francis and 12 followers end up going to the Pope to ask that the Franciscan order be established in about 1209 or 1210. And the Pope does agree. And I feel like Francis must have been terrifically charismatic, because when you think about what he's offering, which absolutely is dedication to God, but the way he wants to do it is different than people have done it before. You are expected to beg constantly for shelter and food. I think that might have been a tough sell, but it doesn't seem to have been. Maybe people were ready for Francis's message. People have argued that the economy of the high Middle Ages, especially in Italy, allowed for people to kind of leave off wealth and want to live this more ascetic mendicant life. But for whatever reason, Francis's order grew in very, very rapidly. By about 1220, there are 3,000 members of the Franciscan order, and it is spreading out of Italy as far as England and into what's now Germany. So it's spreading really rapidly, very quickly. And the traditional narrative is, and I think there's some truth to this traditional narrative, is that Francis is not a very good administrator. You know, he's a charismatic leader, and he really does seem to find joy in nature again, and he loves God, but he's not very good at running a large organization. And I do think that's probably true, but I think it's been overstated in the literature. And the reason I think that, again, is because starting about 1218, we start to see interesting things happen. The first thing, of course, is you're right. He goes to Egypt, does visit the Sultan. You're right. So that trip happens about 1218, 1219. Before that, he actually tries to make a couple of other trips abroad, and he has to turn back due to illness. So we have a constant theme of illness, even in that period when Francis is growing his order and his ministry. When he comes back from that trip to Egypt, he's becoming increasingly infirm. And I use that term deliberately because that's the term infirmitas, which is most often used in the sources. Most scholars think, and I'm inclined to agree with this, that he contracted a trachoma in Egypt. And so that impacted his eyesight from the time he developed it in about 1218, 1219 to the end of his life in 1226. So his eyesight was worsened through that period. And so from about 1220 on, it becomes very difficult for Francis to have the stamina to continually do what he has to do to lead the order. The date is uncertain when Francis actually resigned, but we do have chronicles and lives of Francis that talk about how Francis resigned, and that's the term that's sometimes used, or stepped back from leading his order. Sometime between 1221 and 1223 is likely when that happened. And he cites a number of reasons in various texts. Illness is sometimes cited, and it's cited in the Assisi compilation, which I'm inclined to give a bit more credence to. Other reasons that are given are that he wants to dedicate himself more fully to contemplation of God. And other sources do say that the order had become too large for him to manage. But I do think, and this is the whole point of the book and why I wrote the book, that Francis's experiences of illness and infirmity are one of the main reasons why he chose to do that. Because you're absolutely right. It's really unusual for the founder of an order to step back. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Dominic, who Francis is often compared to, did not ever stop leading his order, you know? So
No, absolutely. And I think it's fair to compare those two because they're absolutely contemporary.
Absolutely, exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
So, and they have very different goals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I enjoy Dominic too. I got asked recently if I was going to do a similar study of Dominic as I did with Francis. And I'm like, well, no, because Dominic was a good organizer, and he organized his order beautifully. And he didn't have the same kind of, as far as I can tell from his lives, the same kind of experience of illness that Francis did. They must have been very different individuals.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So when I think or have thought in the past about Francis stepping back, to me, it seemed like it was probably something difficult to reconcile with when your order is founded on absolute poverty. And all of a sudden, there are all these houses where you have to keep brothers and you have to feed brothers. And also there's the spin-off, the Poor Clares. And for me, my first thought was that it might have been just psychologically difficult to deal with the fact that the reality of the order is much different from the idea to begin with.
Absolutely.
But I think that is worth thinking about. But also, as you're saying, dealing with that practically when your body is not reliable from day to day. And it sounds like from the sources that you were mentioning that sometimes he could do things and sometimes he couldn't do things. And I think that's really valuable when we look at saints' lives, to look at them as people, as human beings. And that's something that you've done. So one of the things that you looked at in order to kind of understand his disability in terms of his visual impairment was to look at his actual writing. So can you tell us a little bit about his writing, the actual pen to paper that Francis did?
Yeah. So this is really, really exciting for me. I've actually only been to Assisi once, only for a day, which is as someone who studies Francis, I spent a lot of time in Siena, but I haven't spent a lot of time in Assisi. When I was in Assisi, I actually got to see a relic of St. Francis, which is a piece of his writing. On one side, it contains a blessing to probably his closest companion who was with him in the last years of his life, Brother Leo. And on the other side, it has a laudatio, I guess, a praises to God. And what's interesting is that you can actually, the two texts were written at different times, and you can actually see differences in the writing. That's what I argue in the book, is that you can actually see the progression of his eyesight deteriorating if you look at those two texts and compare them. The writing gets bigger, there's more mistakes, they're spaced out a bit more. And so you can actually see Francis's eyesight deteriorating in his written work.
Yeah, which is fascinating. It would be something that would show up where you would make that kind of mistake. And as you've said, especially in the book, the spacing is especially relevant because you picture he's probably not writing this outside in bright daylight. He's probably writing it inside. It's so there's only so much illumination he can have, even at a window. And so there are going to be that kind of mistakes. But I think you mentioned in the book that this paper was folded up. It was carried around by Brother Leo with the blessing to Brother Leo on the inside, which I think is just.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can still see the folds and you can tell he carried it until quite late. He lived a long time after Francis. He dies, I can't remember the exact date, but it's in the 1260s sometime. So he kept it with him for decades after Francis died. So it is a lovely.
Him keeping the note to himself that better preserved, I think, is a very sweet detail. So Francis had vision problems for many years, but there's some evidence that people tried to fix that, right? So people were trying to fix visual impairment in the Middle Ages. Can you tell us a little bit about how that worked, how people tried to fix it, and then how people might have tried to fix Francis?
Yeah. So this is a really interesting piece of Francis's life, partially because there's an ongoing debate in the period about whether you should be seeing doctors at all. Vatican II in 1215 ends up having a canon on this. So they come out saying you can see doctors, but it's better for you to take care of the spiritual concerns first. You know, it might be something spiritual, so you should take care of that first. See a priest before you see a doctor, basically. But what's interesting about Francis and his eye impairment in particular is that his order works really hard to try and get that looked after. Francis himself doesn't really seem to care. He would have just lived with it, I think. And in fact, we actually see changes in his rule around this. Earlier, Francis said, you should, in his earliest rule that he wrote for the order, Francis said, don't seek out medical help too quickly. Whatever God determines you should suffer, you should just suffer. And this is how Francis, I think, probably wanted to live his life. The problem with blindness for a medieval saint is that it can be, though it wasn't always, it's really complicated, but it could have been associated with not being able to see the true light of God. Mm-hmm. You know, during the Mass, priests were expected to be able to actually see the Eucharist. And so this isn't necessarily a problem for Francis, who was not a priest, but he was probably a deacon. And so just that blindness could have been a potential impediment to him being able to participate in Masses. And the people who were leading his order, and even I would say the church hierarchy, really wanted Francis to try and get his eye impairment looked at. And so they started off with doctors in Assisi, And one of the very famous stories that's talked about is how Francis actually had his eyes operated on. There was a doctor that came to do a cauterization on an eye. The idea was that he ended up having a burn that went down the side of his face that was intended to draw out the infection.
Oops.
It must have been completely unpleasant. And it's interesting because almost all the hagiographers turn it into a teaching moment in that you should not fear. Fire is nature and fire is our friend and we should not fear. And of course, Francis didn't feel any pain when he had that done because, of course, God was protecting him. But what's interesting about that is it didn't work. Or what's interesting to me, there's lots that's interesting. it didn't work. And so as a result, the leadership of the order ended up asking Francis to go further to look for more. So he ended up going to Raidi to look for medical help for his eyes, where he also saw other doctors, it seems, regularly. And then finally, actually went to Siena, a slightly larger center that at the time had a very small medical school, but also had a family of eye doctors working there. And he went there to try and find a cure. It was not successful at all, but it's very clear that in the last sort of 18 months of Francis's life, the leadership of the order really, really wanted his eye impairment addressed, and not necessarily by God, but by physicians.
Yes, I realized I said the word fix, and I just want to be clear that that's kind of an external position on that, like that people thought this was something that needs to be corrected.
Yeah,
Francis didn't necessarily think he needed that, and that's fine, and he had accommodations. So what were some of his accommodations that he used when he couldn't actually see things necessarily? You mentioned that he couldn't read, and sometimes that is essential when you're participating in mass. So what were some of the accommodations that he came up with?
Yeah. So at the end of his life, he actually couldn't even attend mass. He wasn't strong enough to go and sit. He would hear it, or you would have a colleague or companion read whatever the reading was from the sermon of the day. And this is something that is something that's taken out of later lives of Francis, but he actually was comforted in various ways. So one of the things he really did is he loved music. And so he would ask someone to play a lute. He asked a brother to play a lute at one point, and the brother didn't want to play the lute because the brother was worried that all of his friends would think he's fallen into his previous lifestyle, you know, as someone who wasn't dedicated to God. And so he wouldn't play. And so Francis said, okay, I understand. All right. And then the next evening, he heard music and he was delighted and thought God had sent it to him to sort of comfort him. You know, Francis, I find Francis really human in those moments because it does really demonstrate that he had moments where he was tired and physically hurting, and that he sought out comfort in various ways. And he actually sought out human comfort, which wasn't okay with his hagiographers who felt they had to deal with that. But the earliest attestations, again, from the Assisi compilation, make it really clear that he was okay with saying, you know, I just don't feel good. I'd really like some comfort. And I think that's really an important message. It's gotten lost over time from Francis.
Well, I mean, he's always nice to birds, right?
He's nice to all nature. But he lived in a very ascetic lifestyle, and it's very hard on his body. But in those last moments when I shouldn't say last moments, but in those last years when he's tired and infirm, he's still absolutely dedicated to God and living a holy life. But he wasn't afraid to accept some moments of comfort. And like I said, I think that's a really important message that gets lost in Franciscan hagiography.
And also, I think that when you're talking about, you mentioned his last days. So Francis decided where and when he wanted to die. And he asked for help with that too. Like that was something that he put in motion, which I think is interesting, where sometimes you have saints that are following directions of God, no matter where they lead. And sometimes they're orchestrating things themselves. And so Francis asked for help in order to die the way he wanted to. So how did Francis die?
Yeah, he ended up being able to die where he wanted to die, in San Damiano, you know, where he began his ministry, which is delightful. I do think that there was a real concern, though, because he started falling ill in Siena. Like, it became really clear he was probably in his last few months in Siena. And then various officials moved heaven and earth to get him back to Assisi because it was really important. He was Assisi saint, so it was really important for political reasons that he get back to Assisi. But once he was in Assisi, he absolutely got to be where he wanted to be, which is in San Damiano. But I do think that people beyond Francis worked really hard to get him back quickly to Assisi. Like, he had to be carried back in a litter, but they made sure he got back.
Speaking of orchestrating things, right?
Exactly.
No, I mean, optics are important, and you've mentioned this in editing the saint's life, the hagiography, so that you have it coming across clearly, that his message comes across clearly. I actually was speaking with Levi Roach a few months ago about how the end was more important than the means when it came to even holy things like this. So yeah, you can see the orchestration.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, you can see the political going on behind the scenes all the way through Francis's life. And Francis isn't always totally attuned to it, although around the interventions in terms of his physical body, he's actually there. He sees it and he has to be ordered. Like, he really insists that who's leading the order at the time, who is Brother Elias, the protector of the order, he insists that they order him to seek treatment. So he has that, in some ways, he has that deniability, right? I was ordered to do this. I'm being obedient.
Yeah, well, it's just, it's a tricky thing to be a saint. Okay, so I don't think we can leave a discussion of Francis's physical self behind without addressing stigmata. So this is a tricky one, because if I've read your book correctly, nobody really mentions stigmata until after he's passed away, until after he's died. Is that right?
That is correct. So the story of Francis's stigmata is really complicated. And at the very beginning of the book, I kind of say, I'm going to not talk about stigmata. And I do that because pretty quickly in Francis's tradition, the stigmata become completely believed, that, you know, he had this vision at Liverna of a seraph that transferred Christ's wounds onto his body. And so I didn't, it's partially that I just didn't think it was worth jumping in, and partially because people have done so much better work than I have. So there's a couple of books by Chiara Fregone, which on the stigmata, which are just terrific, which I'll recommend. I didn't want to be drawn into the debate about, you know, whether they're real or not. And truly, I didn't need them to prove my position. I tend to agree with Fregone, who argues basically that Brother Elias was looking at Francis's battered body and tried to come up with an explanation for what he was looking at, and reached out to the idea of Christ's wounds. There's also a more recent article by Carol Musig, I think. I need to check that, but I think it's Carol Musig on the stigmata, that talks about that this idea of the stigmata was in the air around the time of Francis's death, and that it would have been a reasonable explanation to reach for. And I think all of that makes sense, but I also didn't want to necessarily push that in the book. So I can make the argument without referring to the stigmata. So should I explain what stigmata are? Because I haven't done that.
I didn't do that either. Okay, tell us what stigmata are, in case there are people that don't know. I think it's a function of my age that I figure people must know, because not if
and
they didn't even
training.
Go to church, there was a movie, wasn't there like a horror movie called Stigmata?
Yes.
So maybe it's a function of my age. Okay. So tell us, what are stigmata?
So the stigmata were thought to be the wounds that Jesus received on the cross that appeared on the bodies of particular saints. So I know that isn't very satisfying, but I wanted to make the argument without reference to the stigmata. So I don't actually talk about stigmata a lot in the text. Except to say, probably Fregone's right.
Well, I don't mean to pin you down on the stigmata issue, but what I was trying to draw out was that things like stigmata, things like the illness of saints, they are part of a tradition. So it can be very difficult when you're trying to figure out who this person was physically, emotionally, mentally, because there's a pattern that these biographers always follow.
Absolutely.
So I was pushing you to try and say, well, it's hard to say, especially because, you know, there was no mention of stigmata until after he died. And so this is not to say it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But just that when you look at saints' lives, they can be complicated because of these patterns that the writers just follow, and they follow them on purpose.
Absolutely.
But it can be tricky.
Well, and I think it's funny you should say that, because I think, of course, you're exactly right. And I do think we're lucky that we have some non-formulaic texts of Francis, like the Assisi compilation, that it isn't formulaic, that reads much more like reminiscences of old friends. And thank goodness we have that because it allows us to sort of modify our readings of those really formal lives. That's helpful. And the other thing is, I think that even modern scholars' expectations of what a saint's life looks like has helped Francis's life be read in really similar ways since Sabatier wrote his text in like 1898 or whatever it was, like 100 years, more than 120 years ago. I actually think we can fall into the trap of reading saints' lives ourselves, expecting that formula, and that can make us miss really important and interesting aspects of the saint's life. Francis's lived experience is very hard to get to, but I think if we try to read against the grain, we might be able to get a bit closer.
Absolutely. And that's why I had you on the podcast. So that's the perfect place to wrap up. Brilliant.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Donna, for coming on and telling us about St. Francis.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. I really enjoy chatting about it.
Thank you. To find out more about Donna's work, you can follow her on Twitter at medieval@x, or you can visit her website at mystfx.ca/history/Donna-Trembinsky. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey. Well, I know you're a bit of a rogue, right?
Yes, I'm known for that. What are you
Well,
getting at?
we've got a piece here on how to be a rogue this week on medievalist.net. Yes, it is just based on one of the stories from the Al-Mukamet. It's this wonderful 12th century collection of stories involving this con man. His name is Abu Zayed. Oh, it's like all the best. In this one story, he's supposedly on his deathbed and he's telling his son, how to follow in his path. All the advice on how to be a good rogue.
A con man. That sounds more like you, I'm afraid.
Oh, look, I think this is great advice, and I that's why I think it should be shared with the world.
See, you're proving my point right here.
We've got that. And we also got a great piece by Elizabeth Smith Ross, who's been kind of on hiatus for like 6 months, but she's back and she's got a piece on insomniac poets of medieval China.
Oh, I love it. That's amazing.
Yes. Chinese poetry is great. She finds like the most wonderful kind of bits of knowledge. So yeah, it's a great little piece there. So we've got that, and plus like a lot of news on the site.
A lot of news. Awesome. So we can keep up with what's going on right now in the modern medieval world.
Indeed, indeed. If modern, if it's like, 7th century, we've got you covered.
Sounds perfect. All right. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of awesome stuff like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. Summer is coming in, and that means that it's time to register for the summer session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators and get your work in progress back in progress. This is a 6-week online class that I put together with some amazing experts to help people creating medieval fiction get all those little details they need without having to spend a lifetime on the internet. We cover everything from cooking to combat, blacksmithing to textile work, and we do it all with video demonstrations, live classes, helpful bibliographies, recipes, and writing prompts. And you can even ask me anything. The next class begins Friday, July 9th. For all the details, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. For everything from rogues to romances, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sobalski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at all your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.